New Galaxy Enterprises proudly presents Threshold Radio.
This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms, or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication.
This is Johnny Bluestar. We're back on Threshold Radio with a frequent guest, Sarah Westall. Sarah, who's the host of Business Game Changers, a remarkable program that deals with the CEOs, public officials, and technologists who create disruption in business and government, policies that basically change our world for better or for worse. We have had one program on disruptive technologies with a strong emphasis on changes in the music and publishing industry. But we have never really tapped Sarah for a more complete accounting of what she does, i.e., entering directly, emotionally, and intellectually into the core disruptions of our whole society, which is changing at lightning speed. And being in the middle of it, being in the heart of disruption, swinging from purported zero-energy technology to the technology of the police state to the possibilities for widespread alternative currency, is a gauntlet few talk show hosts have ever walked through. Sarah, like myself and so many others in alternative media, are willing to face some very big problems without evading them like conventional media. But Sarah has and continues to take on the very biggest and creates the kind of programming that can directly communicate with listeners who are interested in connecting with the reality of change and disruption. In this sense, Sarah is a very vital messenger and her program deserves attention. In this discussion, Sarah has chosen two very big topics, economics and politics, as well as a few smaller and related ones. As I say, Sarah's perspective is very large, encompassing areas that many have not touched or even heard of. Before we get into our two major themes, the economics and politics of disruption, Sarah, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about why you took on this massive attempt to both chronicle and analyze the major powers of business and technological disruption in our society, including the task of seeking out and talking to some of the major players in this highly sensitive area.
Well, I guess I'm a glutton for punishment. But first of all, thank you for that great introduction. I have so much passion just to figure out what's going on in this world. And I love talking to the people, the experts in different areas that can give us insight on how this change and disruption is making a difference. I come from a technology background. I used to design computer systems, and I also teach at the business school at the University of Minnesota. And I love thinking about how change and disruption is affecting society. And we're changing faster at this time of our lives than any time in history. So it's just an amazing time to be alive.
But what was the first thing that happened to you that made you start to think this way? Do you have any idea?
Well, I do. I think like this probably my whole life. I've thought more and just sat and figured and pondered things. But I built and ran a company for 10 years, and I had an issue with the bank, a bank that was shut down for fraud. And this was right in the middle of the 2008 big debacle. And I pretty much became, I was just possessed almost. That's the wrong word. What word am I trying to look for? I just couldn't stop trying to figure it out. I'm very competitive, and I couldn't learn fast enough what they were doing and what was going on. And, you know, that's a whole episode in of itself, what I went through, but it taught me a lot about the fundamentals of finance and what was going on in our country. And I was almost shaken to the core on how corrupt some of this stuff really is and how good human beings are and how disjoint that is from what's really going on with other facets of our society.
To be honest with you, this reminds me of the fact that for years I never had a savings account, and then I decided to open a savings account. And You know, I thought, well, maybe they'll do 5% or if it's a CD and 3% or something like that. And then I found out it was 0.001%.
Yeah, nothing.
That really, really shocked me because I had never heard that. And that was very recently. It was like, oh, my God, all this is real disruption, isn't it? Because people can't save in the normal way unless they're tying their assets to the stock market with money market.
Yeah, well, they have to tie their assets to the stock market to make sure it keeps up with inflation. But, you know, when we were tied to the gold standard, inflation wasn't like it is today, right? They inflate to eliminate debt. Which, so inflation, if you have a lot of debt, it's not a bad thing. If you don't have a lot of debt and you're saving a lot, then it hurts you.
Yeah. Well, but that's why the Fed has a 2% target for inflation so they can downsize their the national debt.
So too bad we're not on target. Too bad we're way over target. But yeah.
They never seem to make it. Well,
they more than make it.
I'm really happy to say that we can now deal with some of the disruptive components of politics and the economy. So let's start with the economy. I suppose one of the biggest problems with the economy is to know what it is actually like, because as far as I can see, and I pick as an example unemployment statistics, there's a lot of misinformation bandied about. I don't know, but it seems like the extent of this misinformation, which is actually disinformation, that exists in public discourse is disruptive in itself. It's a kind of a covert business policy, a political policy, and an economic policy. Is that correct?
Well, I think the disinformation, they don't want people to realize what's really going on with the economy, because if people knew, then the problem is that people, there's multiple facets with the problem of people knowing and from their perspective. If people don't know and they're ignorant, they can control us and what they want us to perceive. But also we have a habit of, if we think things are bad, we tend to make things really bad.
Yes.
Does that make sense? And so, and they know that. That's the pattern. And so if we think things are good, things will get better. If we think things are bad, things will get worse. And so part of managing society is getting people to think things are good, because then we'll think things are good and things will be better. When we think things are bad, we tend to make things bad, which is a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, pushing back beyond what we know for a fact is deceptive information, how do you personally characterize our economy right now? Is it promising? Is it in a recession or is it in a depression?
Well, if you look at us compared to different countries in the world, other countries are pretty much the whole world's in a recession and some are in a depression. And you can read the headlines of what's going on in Brazil currently with the Olympics, or you look at what's going on with the Eurozone. We are in a better shape than they are at this moment in time, but that is just, I think it's more of an illusion. Or it's temporary. We will have to have a point where we have to deal with the debts. We have to deal with the fact that there's so many dollars printed that the value of the dollar has gone to a very small amount. If you create too many dollars, then the dollar ends up being worth almost nothing. And that's what hyperinflation is. And at some point, we're going to have to deal with some of this stuff, the debt, the... If we have so much debt that if you raise the interest rate on what we pay for debt, it becomes a substantial part of our budget that we can't handle. So there's just the formula has gotten out of hand.
Well, you know, we're all concerned about what's causing this. And you had a meeting with an Andrew Hoffman. Tell us a little bit about him and let's hear a little clip of what he said.
Well, let me tell you a little bit. I have such amazing people that I interview, and he is no exception. Miles Franklin is one of the oldest and largest gold suppliers, and they're an investment house in the country. And he's the media director and a finance expert from Miles Franklin. He represents them from the media perspective. But we had a great interview and great conversation about this. But I asked him, and this is the clip, I asked him whether all of this was a grand conspiracy. Like, is there some player up there, a group of people that are manipulating everything, or whether it's not that? And this is what he said.
Do you believe that's a grand conspiracy, or do you think we're just all clueless and it's just happening because we don't know what else to do?
Well, you ask very good questions, Sarah, because especially in my world, you know, I report on alternative media things and, you know, for instance, the manipulation of gold, which I've been talking about for 15 years and proving, because I'm a Wall Street analyst by background, so I don't just, I have conspiracy theories, I prove it.
Well, because I don't like conspiracy theories. I liked it to be real. Otherwise, nobody takes it seriously. So I want to know, is it possible for somebody to actually, to a group of people to actually plan this? Or is it just, we're just so desperate and so out of control that this is what happens?
Right. And that's why this is such a great question. Because in my world, I am exposed to many, many people who have theories about this, and many people say very strongly it's the elites, it's the Rothschilds, it's the Bilderbergs, it's the bankers, it's this. And look, I mean, yes, there's definitely a lot of people out there who have similar goals. Like, for instance, every one of the major Western nations has a goal of maintaining the status quo of fiat currency. But to believe they're all getting together when, first of all, they all hate each other, they don't even speak the same language, they have completely different goals, to think that a small group of people are planning this. I mean, you can't make up fiction stories about how look, like what's going on in Japan with their helicopter money. No, I believe, as I've called them, that it's just a bunch of Keystone Cops. They wake up every day playing defense. The fact is, these Keystone Cops happen to be armed with printing presses and care of Wall Street, some of the most diabolical modern financial and trading technology around. They can hide everything. The Fed can hide all its money printing. They can trade offshore in high frequency trading and hide what they're doing. And they're very good at manipulating markets and economic data to the point where they've been able to kick the can for a long time. But the point is, at some point, and that's how we started the call, rubber hits the road.
But if they can hide everything and it can be, not be transparent, you could hide it for a long time.
Well, that's very, very interesting. And We'll pursue this in our next segment.
Okay. Well, as you heard, he thinks it's a bunch of Keystone Cops, right? He thinks that everybody's always reacting to whatever's going on. And I got to say, he has a lot of points to that, and what's pointing, to that scenario, because he pointed out during the interview that so much of what's going on is incompetence. And how can people be planning this and it turning out the way it is? So in that way, he has a point. But I've had other people on the show, like Irvin Goldman, who was an executive at J.P. Morgan, and he's held CEO of different finance companies. And his view on it is there's three major players that are controlling things, and they're kind of jockeying and fighting over it. And it's the U.S., the European area, including the European Union, and then it's also China and the Eastern powers. So he's saying there's three major players that are fighting for control over our money supply and economics. And that makes a lot of sense to me. So I believe it's a combination of things. It's a combination of a bunch of Keystone Cops as things happen and players at a high level trying to fight for power and domination of this space. Because the group that controls the reserve currency, which is a dollar currently, has so much power, and they want to control that.
Well, that's really interesting, and we'll be right back to discuss more elements of the disruption in our economy.
From my eyes, I remember that day. My company, New Galaxy Enterprises, is a California corporation specializing in the creation of media and promotional content. We are focused on original, innovative projects that are good for humanity. These projects could be nonfiction books or novels, fictional screenplays or documentary content, websites and website content, commercial advertising content for print, audio, or video products on the internet, television, or radio, musical scores for advertising, television, or film, video, audio editing, etc. We want to promote products and projects that support the environment, encourage a healthy experience in living, developing, nurturing, and useful technology, and offering platforms for positive, socially constructive entertainment or informative, transformative media. Our experience in creating a variety of products like this is rather vast, and we offer client-based and collaborative products, as well as the opportunity of active investors to join us in the creation and promotion of proprietary products, some of which are in latter stages of development. For more information, go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. That's www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. If you're interested in talking to us, just fill out the contact sheet and we will get back with you.
The following is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here! There's too many of them!" Again, we saw the Chinese soldiers charging in with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped two hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
We're back with Sarah Westall discussing the state of the economy. In your exchange with Andy Kaufman, you asked him a question that bothers most of us. What's it all about? The economy, that is, stupid. So that's kind of the Clinton answer a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, the economy is, it will affect all of us, right? The one thing that our politicians and the way that they have affected and manipulated people is they get everybody focused on social issues. And part of the reason is because people can't, not a lot of people don't think about money issues or they think about the economy as far as it affects them on a daily basis. How expensive is their food? Can they go out and be entertained? And can they do all these things? But as far as some of this bigger stuff, and so what happens is politicians, and this is really big, this cycle in politics, is they're really getting people focused on the social issues, you know, the Black Lives Matter. And, you know, they do have issues and it is a problem and they aren't getting the jobs like others are. And, you know, we need to fix that and get over it for finally get over some of these issues. But they get us all focused on that and not on some of these bigger issues. And so the economy, stupid, is really what it's about.
Well, one of the things that is really serious about the financial crisis is the corruption there is in banking. And now you were speaking to someone named Bill Black in one of your recent interviews. Tell us a little bit about him.
Okay, well, he's amazing. He, like so many, like I said, so many of my interviews are with amazing people. He led the SEC prosecutions back in the early 90s, and they put thousands of banking executives in jail or in prison for the corruption that they were doing at that time. They really cleaned up the industry, right? I mean, they didn't totally clean it up. There's always corruption at some level, but they really made a dent in the corruption that was going on in the banking industry at that time. And then he was also, and he was in charge of that. He led those prosecutions. And then he also was put in position to come up with new regulations for the industry. And, you know, he's been out of that world for a while. But he, when the whole 2008 thing happened, it just, he was just, it's like bring Benjamin Franklin back and Thomas Jefferson back and looking at our how we're running our country today. That's kind of how he, I'm assuming he thought about the banking scandals.
So let's hear a little bit about the things that you asked him.
criminology these days, we talk about the use as of the firm as weapon, and the ammunition that firms use, particularly in finance, is accounting. So this was a form of accounting fraud, and it turned out this recipe had four ingredients. One, grow like crazy. Two, by making really, really, really crappy loans, but at a premium nominal yield. And we can come back to what nominal means and why that's important.
Okay.
Three, while employing extreme leverage, that just means a whole lot of debt compared to your equity. And four, while setting aside virtually no allowances for loan and lease losses, in jargon, the all provision. In other words, virtually no loss reserves for the enormous losses that were sure to come from making enormous numbers of crappy loans.
Well, from a corruption standpoint, one of the big things that he pointed out is that there's a pattern of fraud, and that's what they figured out. And this is what the clip is that pattern that they figured out. Because at first it was hard to do the prosecutions; it was hard to get to the evidence. And then once they figured out the pattern, it was easy to identify, and then it was easy to prosecute. And one thing he points out too, and it's probably not in this clip, but for sure in the interview that where we discussed, is that they had more whistleblowers and more evidence with this current runaround and the corruption that's been going on since 2008 and before that than they had back in 1990, yet nobody was prosecuted. So it wasn't that they didn't have the evidence and didn't have the material to be able to take these executives and criminals down. They didn't have the political will to do it. And that's what he is telling people and what he's pressing so much. And he's very passionate about getting his message out there because he knows he was in the thick of it.
Well, it's also because the criminality is so, we're so used to it, it's transparent. They do it right in front of us.
Yeah, they don't even try to hide it anymore. And it's just, it's crazy. And what they do, one of the big things is they just take a penalty. Okay, so I made $3 billion doing this fraud where we're manipulating some rate, but yet they're only going to penalize me $200 million. Okay, well, that means that this business transaction cost me $200 million.
You know, since I'm kind of an amateur stock market watcher, very amateur, I can't help but notice what a profound effect statements by the Fed or other central bankers can have on all the stock markets in the world, especially ours. How on earth did Congress give up its right to control the economy to a private institution? Now, I don't know much about the Fed, but I definitely sympathize with your point of view in exchange you had with Michael Jones.
No, that's okay. Michael Johns is the co-founder of the Tea Party, and he was also a speechwriter for Bush, and he was senior, had very many senior positions in different senators, and I believe he worked for a governor as well. He's pretty connected in the political world, but we talked a lot about taxes, and he's, as you know, he's co-founder of the Tea Party, so he tends to be pretty more to the right, but they're against more taxes. And so we talked a lot about, you know, what the Tea Party's for. But then we got into the Federal Reserve, and this is what this clip is about. And he gave a passionate argument on why the Federal Reserve cannot be, the control of money should not be left to Congress. And his argument is the Congress just, it's too sophisticated for Congress, and we do not have people in Congress that understand money enough to make these decisions. And actually, his points are valid. However, we definitely need to have a body of people that are controlled somehow through Congress. We have to figure this out, because it's one thing to not have Congress who does not have the experience or expertise to actually make the decisions. It's another thing to have a rogue organization who prints money under our name, spend money under our name, makes profits under our name, and we have no idea what's going on because we can't audit them. Think of any business executive in the world that runs a company of any size. If you took away their budget and you took away all their financial stuff and said, well, you can't see the finances, but here's your budget each year that you can use, and don't bother auditing us because you don't have the right to audit us because we're private. But by the way, if we give away a couple $1 trillion, you're still going to be on the hook for it because we're doing it under your name. Who would go with that? No, there isn't an executive on the planet that would go with that. It's so obvious.
Well, it's again that criminality right on the table, because I do think depriving Congress and the rest of the United States of the right to control their currency and control their economy. And besides, what the Fed does is not the usual thing that banks do. It's gone into a completely different scenario. So I'm not sure that understanding is as much the point as not having it in the first place to understand.
Well, I think having minimal control over it would be better than nothing. I mean, it's a total rogue organization right now, right? We did a one-time audit and we found that $16 trillion was giving overseas to, you know, foreign banks to bail them out and do different things. I don't know what happened to it now. They claim it's all been back, but who knows? We never audited them again. Yet we shut down Congress for a week for $900 billion. I mean, that's an amazing number. But we shut down Congress for a week because of $900 billion and everybody's arguing. Yet behind the scenes, they're giving away $16 trillion. You know, I mean, it's just crazy. And the fact, and, you know, when you get back to Clinton saying it's about the economy, stupid. If people can't see it's about the economy, when you think about numbers like that, what's the point? You know, I mean, it's so obvious that this is the biggest problem we have sitting in front of us. Like I said to a friend of mine last week, we're having coffee and I'm like, you know, all these social issues are a major issue, right? People need to be treated with respect and we treat people bad. But at the end of the day, if our currency collapses and we can't eat, or if I can't get paid to be able to pay my mortgage and, you know, feed my kids, I don't care if the person down the street's calling me names or doesn't respect me. Because I care more about feeding myself and having the basics, you know.
It's called survival.
Yeah. And this is so tied to that.
Well, let's go and listen to this clip, because I can tell you, having heard it, it's rather dramatic.
What do you think about the Federal Reserve? Should it be audited or should it be replaced? What are you thinking about that?
There's no reason not to audit the Federal Reserve. And the only real opponents to that audit are the Federal Reserve. And one of their...
They're strong, though, because it never happened.
One of their objections, I believe, is that if you look at the congressional testimony that given by the Fed by, you know, say the chair now, Yellen, when Yellen goes up and talks to Congress, it's like two people talking over each other's heads. Congress does not understand the Federal Reserve at all. They do not understand it. Would be okay. We don't need a Congress that understands everything as long as they understand that they don't understand everything. So, you know, if you're like, we don't understand this, but we are going to endeavor to understand it, that's okay. But if you think you understand it and you don't even understand the most basic fundamentals of it, and then you've got someone like Janet Yellen who's going to come up who's intimately involved on a daily basis on the complexities that they don't understand, they're talking over each other's heads. And I believe that's been going on for decades. And so the Federal Reserve has become this hugely misunderstood, stigmatized institution. It should be audited, but it also needs to be.
The Fed also needs
to communicate better. They've got to be able to also, just inconsistent with what I was saying with national security and foreign policy, the American people should understand our central banking system functions.
How can any business person that runs a company of any size not be just completely annoyed with the fact that we don't know what's going on with our own money?
One of the biggest lessons I drew from over a decade in Washington, D.C., in both policy circles and in government, is that that when you come up into public policy, you're very well educated on fiscal policy. You know, so like within D.C. political culture, there's a pretty good understanding of tax policy and spending. There's very, very limited understanding of monetary policy. So if you get into, say, interbank lending or repurchase agreements or, you know, the Fed funds rate or term options, you know, interest on reserves, deposit facilities, any of this stuff is, even to, like, economists, is an alien language.
Yep, that makes sense.
And, yeah, so I think we need...
But that doesn't
a much
mean,
broader degree of understanding yes. of how this system actually functions.
Because to not audit
it doesn't mean that we should audit it. Yeah, absolutely. Like it's, like, totally, it's entirely
here,
reasonable. But you should,
go ahead and do
we should also
you
understand.
Want.
Yeah, but you also understand when you audit the Federal Reserve, it's not like auditing the you know the finances of a 7-Eleven. I mean, it's
that's
there's
fine.
Particular
that's fine, but to not,
structure of the Fed.
But to yeah. not audit is lunacy.
It just seems to me a super preposterous situation when you have a private bank controlling the printing of fiat money and state of interest rates, and it's not directly accountable to the people, at least through their representatives, that they can actually, as I've heard before, claim independence from the federal government's control. What a shame. And we're going to come back in just a few minutes and talk a little bit more about the economy.
We must have known this place before. Cruelly on the shore, and wind carves out remorseful runes in deep shadows on silver dunes. I know your touch, your smell, your glance. This could not be some trick of chance. We whirl around this windswept beach, entranced by love beyond our reach. Your kisses
New Galaxy Enterprises is a media company specializing in wide-ranging content like novels, nonfiction books, screenplays, commercial advertising, web content, etc. One of our most esteemed providers is illustrator Robert W. Zalo. I work on all my most important projects like book covers, logos, web design elements with Robert. As an illustrator, he worked on the Ignatz-nominated comic book, The Expert's Guide to Killing Things That Go Bump in the Night. His skills encompass advertising, magazine illustrations, gaming, comic books, TV production, and scenic painting. His clients include Comcast, Adelphia, Haven Talent, Forceworks, High Octane Theater, Star Creative Advertising. If you wish to contact Robert, go to johnnybluestar.com and let me know. That's johnnybluestar.com. For artist illustrator Robert Zalo, an essential component of all the work we do. Maybe he can help you too.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We could take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
By God, are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
One of the programs you created featured the author of Hoodwinked and two different editions of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. More than most people, he has chronicled the way government and private corporations conspire to exercise an overreaching control over countries throughout the world. Let's listen to this clip, and then maybe we can discuss both what he did and what it all means. Is that all right?
Yep.
Well, I think it's fair to say that economic hitmen have really created the world's first truly global empire. And it's really a corporate empire, not an American empire. It's supported by the U.S. government to a large degree, the Pentagon, the CIA, et cetera. But it's really a corporate empire. And economic hitmen work in a number of different ways, but perhaps the most generic description would be to say that we identify countries with resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange huge loans to those countries from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. However, the money doesn't actually go to the countries. Instead, it goes to our own corporations that make huge profits off building big infrastructure projects.
So, I mean, this is amazing. Here we have a government that pretends to be benign, has worked out a sort of a deal between corporations and certain people within the government to go out there to a country and offer them this wonderful opportunity to build their infrastructure, maybe irrigation and crops or certain types of energy, you know, like a big electrical grid that they desperately need, all sorts of things. And then they basically farm out the work to corporations in the United States and debt these people. And then because they're in debt, they have to make tremendous concessions.
Well, they do this on purpose to be able to control them from a big picture standpoint, you know, so we don't have to control people or control countries militarily. We control them economically through these means. So there is some strategic advantage to this. And to a certain degree, it makes sense, but we're impoverishing and holding people back. And that's where the problem is. And the countries that try to fight back and keep that from happening, we take out their leaders. That's where it's sad, right? And if you look at what's happened and you analyze what's happened in different countries, you realize that pattern really is going on. And it's disheartening. This show really bothered me. I had to think about it for... which is too bad. I thought I have so many uplifting shows that I do as well. And so this show with you is not as uplifting because we're talking about kind of the state of economics and politics right now. But this is one of the I think it's evil things that we do. And there's a lot of business executives that are in high places that do not like this and want this to change. And if they could, they would change it. But the problem is that it's always considered national defense. It's always considered strategy. It's always considered all these things. And then you get people in power that keep perpetuating this situation. And this is what we have going on.
You know, it's funny how so often greed is tied to scarcity. It's as though people who are really greedy and selfish buy into the idea that they have to have all the marbles in their side. Whereas other people, I think that on a more spiritual level, if you like, believe that there's room for all of us.
Well, there is room for all of us. The earth has the resources to support everyone. But if you have certain people that want to hoard it and take it all, then it obviously doesn't. So we have to rethink and we just can't be like that. Right? We have to be better.
I think that what we need to do is learn about the kind of state of mind, the state of spirit that we need in order to confront things. That's why I consider this program to be basically a kind of spiritual program, where the idea is to, if you can connect to that sort of treasure inside of yourself, then you will get the things and be able to do the things that you want. And that could, I also believe that on a collective basis. If enough go ahead.
Yes, I agree with you. I think that to fight this, I think people in leadership positions around our country who have the courage, they need to have the courage to do what's necessary to make this right. And that's what we are sort of lacking right now, is the courage to stand up to the people who are egomaniacs and the narcissists who are in power. And there are good people who are in power that understand this, and they need to have the courage to stand up and to do what's right. And until we have enough of those people doing that, it's not going to change. Because good, I believe, overall triumphs over evil. because the collective, people want to be in a collective good environment. You know, we ended slavery. As we evolve as a species, we end the real bad stuff. But underlying, there's always something else bad that happens. But it's the good and the will of the people and the good leaders that can come forward and have the courage, like I said, to do what's necessary.
We just need a strong, even if it's not a majority, a strong, educated, informed, and enlightened minority of people.
Yes.
Who are activists who want to make things happen.
And there has to be enough of them to do it.
Well, I want to turn the, since we're talking about the economics still, I want to talk about the role of gold in the economy. It serves as a kind of safe haven for investors if the American currency collapses. Some say this is inevitable and gold investments are the answer right now. Is this thinking sound? And as your guest Andy Hoffman said, is it true that the price of gold has been perennially manipulated through the centuries as well as now?
Well, yeah, and that's the common wisdom, is that gold is being manipulated, silver even more. And I think silver because it's a industrial metal. And because right now, historical ratios between gold and silver were always closer than what they are now. I think silver should be at about 50, 60, something like that, to have historical ratios with gold. But they're just being kept down. As Ed Moy, who was the director of the U.S. Mint under Obama and Bush, he's a great, great man. And he talked about the fact that gold is pretty much at the lowest point it could be because it's at the cost to mine the gold and distribute it. It can't really go any lower because that's how low it is.
It's lower than for a lot of small mining companies.
Yes.
It's lower than it needs to be. And that's why these junior mining companies go out of business a lot of times during these periods. And some of them are very clever and they figure out a way to be more cost efficient, but they still need to sometimes bide their time until the price of gold goes up. Right now it's fluctuating rather strongly.
Well, and so when there's so much demand for gold and the price is below the cost to, or at the cost to mine and manufacture and distribute for the large companies, not just, you know, small companies have higher costs per unit. When it's at that, it's artificially low. I mean, supply, demand, the whole market cycle's not working, right? Because if demand is high and the cost is at what it costs a large corporation to mine and distribute with very, very little profit, it's obviously not working properly. Right. Nobody's going to sell gold at, and these small companies below their cost. So there's something wrong. And so it's very clearly manipulated when it's below market demand.
Well, besides gold being a safe haven, there's another safe haven that's afoot, and that is cryptocurrencies. Now, I was involved in the barter industry for quite a number of years as a trade director, and I worked every day with legal alternative currency, which happened, I don't know, I guess in the 1990s, there was an agreement between the barter companies and the IRS that instead of, you know, auditing all these people who remember barter companies, these people would hand in 1099s based on what they actually used in barter for their business. And so this has actually been a very strong part of this, a strong but minor part of our economy, alternative currency. Now, with the coming of Bitcoin, you're talking about something that alternative currency that has become a major, major event. And I think you have a discussion by the man you mentioned before, Ed Moy, the former director of the U.S. Mint, talking about this. Shall we listen?
Yes, let's go for it.
Based on that, are governments pretty receptive to Bitcoin, knowing that there's a little bit more transparency with those transactions?
Yes and no. So there are governments like Ecuador that have tried to develop their own version of Bitcoin, and there's a lot of reasons why they wanted to do that. Switzerland considered legislation last year that failed, but may come about this year, that basically recognizes Bitcoin as another currency like it does the euro and the yen.
Sure.
And so there are countries that are really receptive to it. Great Britain, the Bank of England is considering developing their own cryptocurrency and using it to protect their pound sterling. The United States mainly has a wait and see attitude with all these agencies kind of figuring it out among themselves. And then there are other countries like China and Russia, and not surprisingly, they're very centralized governments. They are extremely suspicious, if not outright hostile, to decentralized currencies like cryptocurrencies.
So the United States is much more open to it than China and Russia.
Yes, Yeah, I agree with that.
So are we moving towards a cashless society?
Well, you know, there's certainly a lot of talk about it, and there's some economic factors that are interesting that are kind of accelerating this move. And so, you know, just from a day-to-day perspective, Americans use a wide variety of payment mechanisms, right? We use credit cards, we use checks, we use cash, we use wire transfers, etc. But there are other countries like Denmark and Sweden and Norway who are trying to promote a cashless society. And when you take a look at like Sweden and Norway, they're basically, they're very centralized governments that provide a lot of social benefits, and that type of approach to government leads them down the path of wanting a cashless society. And there's some benefits to that. Obviously, it's a lot easier swiping a credit card than it is counting out cash. Some would even make, you know, the minor argument that because hands handle cash, then germs get transmitted, you know, cash transactions and things like that. But bottom line is that there are countries like Sweden and Norway that are exploring becoming completely cashless.
That's amazing.
Well, he's talking about what countries are for it and what aren't for it, and what how they view, you know, cryptocurrencies. And cryptocurrencies in some countries, if you listen to this interview, which is a two-part interview that I do with him, cryptocurrencies can do amazing things for like the unbankable countries where people don't have bank accounts and so they can't do basic business transactions. It allows them to be able to do business and to make money and to buy food and to do all these things. So there's so many good things about it. So once you get past that, you know, and you look at the big picture stuff, you know, what's going on with it and why are they pushing it? Well, there's multiple facets to that. You look at Russia and China and they're scared to death of it because they know that with some of the cryptocurrencies, they can't control it. It's completely distributed and they're afraid of it. And they want to be able to control their centralized governments. They want to be able to control their stuff. But you look at the other spectrum of centralized governments and they want to put their own cryptocurrencies in place. You know, the socialist countries, because they want to control every bit of it and get every dollar of tax money and not allow any fraud and completely control their citizens. So there's a good and a bad with cryptocurrencies. If it gets implemented where the government controls it, they control everything. And what happens when the wrong actors in government gets in charge? I mean, that's what Thomas Jefferson and all these characters were worried about, in making sure there was a balance of power, because you know, we all want to think that our government officials are angelic and they're great, but they're people. And so you get the wrong characters in Washington and wrong characters in charge of this stuff, and they can do some pretty bad stuff. And so you have to make sure that your currency has some freedom attached to it.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that happened in the barter industry, and I actually wrote a newsletter sort of about the entire barter industry, interviewing a lot of people who were running exchanges or dealt with exchanges, was that there was tremendous corruption in it because it wasn't regulated. There was a lot of fraud. I was in charge of an area for BXI where a lot of these trade directors had been dismissed because of things they did wrong, and sometimes because the company probably didn't understand what they were doing right. But so, you know, it's a balance in everything, right, Sarah?
There is a balance, yeah. And that's what I talked to Ed Moy about that in that interview, is there's a way with like Bitcoin to get at some of the fraudulent transactions without taking away their right of freedom. And it's a very interesting conversation that we had about how do we create that balancing act where we can get the bad actors out of the system. I mean, nobody wants criminals. I mean, that's the point. Let's get these criminals out of the system. So if they're doing this fraud transactions, there's ways to get them out with cryptocurrencies while still maintaining your anonymous, you know, not to have to be tracked for everything that you do. And so it's a very interesting conversation we had about how to manage cryptocurrencies in a way that benefits society without taking away your rights and freedoms.
Well, we have a clip here. It's not sort of on the broader sense about cryptocurrency, but it's very specific. But it's really, really a great little clip by one of the, maybe the first inventor of the blockchain.
I know that, you know, the Chinese have been working on using supercomputing power to look for ways to crack the SHA family of hash values. And I believe Bitcoin uses the SHA-256. I use two separate hash functions simultaneously, which would make pedal considerably more difficult to forge or crack than Bitcoin.
So they could use your system for Bitcoin, couldn't they? If they ended up cracking the blockchaining that is used in Bitcoin, they could switch over to your system, and your system would be even more secure.
Somebody could do so, yes.
Wasn't that interesting?
Well, I really enjoyed talking to Kels Wilson. He is an amazing person. If you look at his background, he has PhDs in multiple disciplines, but he also went back and got his patent. He's a patent lawyer as well. And because he wanted to protect his own patents, because he had different things that he's discovered and so forth. But he was the original inventor of blockchain. And there's an idea that there's a Japanese sounding name, and I don't have it right in front of me, that actually came up with blockchain, but it's not. It was actually Kels Wilson that came up with it. And he's used it. It's identical application of what they use in Bitcoin, but he uses it for another purpose. But his way of using it makes it completely impervious to hacking. Bitcoin is pretty hard to hack into, but he knows that, you know, like China's feverishly trying to figure out how to hack into it. Like we talked about earlier with Ed Moy, they don't like the idea of Bitcoin. And so they're trying to figure out, how do we get into this currency? And I think, I think they'll figure it out. But his way of doing it, and he explains it in the interview, is it's completely impervious. There's no way. And they can implement his stuff in Bitcoin and improve it to the point where no government could hack into it. And I think that's very, very interesting.
Following is a song recorded by Patricia Welch. It was written by myself as lyricist and by Edgar Ahrens, who both produced it, played it, and wrote the music. It's called Desperate Games.
Your shadow marks the brazen breeze. I sense you near and slowly.
This is Johnny Blue Star. I've worked as a lyricist with Patricia Welch for over 5 years, along with Russian composer Edgar Ahrens, a friend and colleague. Her ability as a singer is simply amazing. She brings a unique and dramatic flair to every song she sings. Over the next few months, we shall be releasing a number of these songs, part of an album called Hadley's Castle. Meanwhile, Patricia has been busy creating a super enjoyable collection of classic standards in an exciting 46-song, 3-CD collection.
Music for Great Entertaining introduces Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia Welch. 3 hours of continuous music. 46 of the all-time classic standards, spanning decades of hit songs. Going to a friend's home for dinner? Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia also makes the perfect hostess gift. This 3-CD compilation is the perfect background music that sets just the right mood for any dinner party.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy.
To purchase this album, just go to patriciawelch.com/CD. That is patriciawelch.com/CD. You won't be disappointed. Well, you know, we've discussed a lot of different components of the economy, certainly not everything, but certainly we do see more clearly how disruptive these type of policies and practices have in some of the technology, which is, you know, Bitcoin, which we just discussed. In our next hour, we're going to discuss more or less the political kind of disruption that's been going place.